Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Are we seeing the real end of the Cold War right now playing out? Following behind-the-scenes talks in Washington, Havana, and possibly even the Vatican, American contractor and prisoner in Cuba for 5 years, Alan Gross, was released today. The release heralded new, tangible changes in the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba for the first time since Fidel Castro came to power. We begin this hour exploring what looks like a major diplomatic shift in relations. President Obama announced talks with Cuba will begin, and a U.S. embassy will open in Havana for the first time in more than half a century.
In the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years, we will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries. Through these changes, we intend to create more opportunities for the American and Cuban people and begin a new chapter among the nations of the Americas.
Prisoner Alan Gross, now on American soil, who began all of this, was serving a 15-year sentence accused of trying to bring internet services to Cuba. Along with Gross's release, 52 other political prisoners are being released by Cuba. The United States is releasing three accused Cuban spies who've been held in American prison since 1981. And however it looks, officials insist this is not technically a prisoner swap. Today's deal to release Gross and move towards opening talks with Cuba has been in the works secretly for 18 months, in part encouraged by Pope Francis, who held a meeting at the Vatican with American and Cuban officials. This is a nuanced thaw in relations. The United States is easing restrictions on remittances, travel, and banking relations, but technically the decades-old American embargo on Cuba will remain in place for now. It can only be lifted by an act of Congress. Joining us now is Carlos Ayer, professor of history and religious studies at Yale University and author of Waiting for Snow in Havana and Learning to Die in Havana. Professor Ayer, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for inviting me to your program.
So how does this sort of figure into the history of your own family?
Well, most of my family remained in Cuba, but they've all died off one by one because I left in 1962 when I was only 11. So, the Castro regime split up my family and split up millions of Cuban families. And this doesn't really change anything. For most people, it's more or less a tiny step that the U.S. is taking. It remains to be seen what steps are being taken on the Cuban end. But basically, I don't see anything changing, anything of substance so far. It's too early to tell.
Would you say this is a belated and surprise development that's taken place here, as small as it is?
I'm not the least bit surprised. I think the Obama administration has been working towards this as a goal since 2009. And in the last 18 months, it kind of sped up, and Alan Gross was standing in the way. But this has been in the works for a long time. This has been a very deliberate policy shift that the Obama administration has had in mind for a very long time.
Stepping down from your academic tower for just a moment, what does this tangibly mean for exiles in the United States and for people in Cuba, as far as you can tell at this point?
Yeah, as far as we can tell, because we don't know what changes, if any, will take place on the Cuban end. Exiles are not affected by this, but people who live in Cuba, all of the leading opponents of the Castro regime, all of the leading dissidents in Cuba have opposed vehemently the lifting of the embargo. They think it will only cause more repression in Cuba. And this year, so far, we've had more arrests than in the previous 4 or 5 years. So these 53 who are supposedly being released, these 53 political prisoners, that's a small fraction of the total. And it remains to be seen what happens to these 53 after they're freed. So it's very hard to tell. The so-called reforms that Raul Castro has put into effect are not real reforms. The only people who are profiting from these so-called reforms are the children of the oligarchs, such as the children of all the generals who run the country. I think one needs to look at this very carefully and with a measure of suspicion as to what's going to happen at the other end.
Well, that suspicious tone from Carlos Ayer, who's professor of history and religious studies at Yale University, is echoed by a lot of politicians in the United States reacting to the news today. Here's Senator Marco Rubio on Fox News.
Now all of these tyrants around the world know that the U.S. can be had, that it's a pretty easy deal. At a minimum, I would say this. Barack Obama is the worst negotiator of that we've had as president since at least Jimmy Carter and maybe in the modern history of this country.
Putting the sort of rhetoric aside and the partisanship on this matter, which, of course, is famous on this whole issue of Cuba. It's been a very partisan issue going back to the 1960s. You know, should President Obama have gotten some tangible concessions up front here to make you feel better about this, Carlos Ayer?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And I think, you know, let's put Alan Gross out of the picture here. I'm so glad that he was finally freed. I've been for the last 5 years that he's been in prison. You know, I've been seething because I knew that the Castro regime would not release this very innocent man unless the U.S. gave him something really big. And the U.S. has. But I think that on the other end, the Cuban end, this is only going to strengthen the Castro regime. Of course, let's look 10 years down the road. Raul is in his 80s. He's not going to stay in power forever, thank God. And it remains to be seen what happens once he's out of the picture, too. So I'm not looking at today. I'm looking 5, 8, 10 years down the road. Once the Castro brothers are gone, then we might see some substantial change, maybe.
What
we don't know.
What is the significance of the Vatican apparently being involved in some of the intermediate talks here?
Well, this was news months ago, so it doesn't surprise me in the least. The Cuban Catholic Church is much like the old Russian Orthodox Church was in the Soviet Union, is basically a branch of the government. So that has helped with these negotiations. But I think Pope Francis has put in his 2 cents and has honestly looked for the release of Alan Gross because that was such an injustice. I don't know what other deals they have struck.
But would you say that Pope Francis is playing a kind of parallel role to, you know, Pope John Paul II in the sense that as a Pole, he had enormous influence in the Cold War period of the 1980s. Here, Pope Francis, coming from Argentina, possibly has a similar role to play in the much smaller divisions between the U.S. and Cuba.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. But again, we don't know what's going to happen down the road. The Catholic Church in Cuba is headed by Cardinal Jaime Ortega, who was himself a political prisoner many years ago, but has ever since he rose to lead the hierarchy in the Cuban church, ever since he has been a very, very strong supporter of the Castro regime. And actually on his diocesan website a couple of years ago, there was a statement by him that anyone who wants to change the present political system in Cuba should not have a role in determining the future of Cuba. It's about as far as one can go in saying, let's keep things the same. That message was later removed from the website, so it's impossible to find now. But
Well, you know, among those sort of tea leaves, the president has thanked the Pope for his role in actually you know, helping to take these steps, or at least for the release of Alan Gross. Do you think there's any argument before we go for a constructive engagement here in the way that the U.S. dealt with South Africa, in that being more engaged means that we're more likely to have a role once the Castro brothers are out?
Well, I think the best way to engage, actually, it's just the opposite direction. The reason that apartheid ended in South Africa was that the entire world boycotted South Africa. And I think that's what should happen with Cuba. I think the only real step towards progress No matter how many times the U.S. and Cuba talk about this, the real step towards progress for a good future for Cuba is the removal of the Castro dynasty and the reestablishment of a democratic republic. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, thanks in part to this event today,
Carlos,
which
Ayer
is going to strengthen the Castro dictatorship.
Carlos Ayer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Carlos Ayer is professor of history and religious studies at Yale University, author of Waiting for Snow in Havana and Learning to Die in Havana. Calls for the Castro brothers to establish a democratic regime in Cuba presumably was not the subject of 45 minutes of a conversation by phone between President Obama and Raul Castro, the first presidential-level discussion of significance since the Cuban Revolution. Here is President Obama speaking today on the changes that we've just announced.
To the Cuban people, America extends a hand of friendship. Some of you have looked to us as a source of hope, and we will continue to shine a light of freedom. Others have seen us as a former colonizer, intent on controlling your future. José Martí once said, "Liberty is the right of every man to be honest." Today, I'm being honest with you. We can never erase the history between us, but we believe that you should be empowered to live with dignity and self-determination. Cubans have a saying about daily life. No es fácil. It's not easy. Today, the United States wants to be a partner in making the lives of ordinary Cubans a little bit easier, more free, more prosperous.
President Barack Obama speaking today, heralding a thaw in Cuban-American relations, perhaps the first significant step in a half century. An end to the freeze between Havana and Washington could be transformative on the ground in Florida politics. South Florida has long been dominated by the conservative, stalwart, anti-Castro Cold Warriors in the Cuban exile community. But much has changed in the decades following the fall of Batista, 1960, and the Bay of Pigs fiasco. Florida is now a very different place than it was when the U.S. embargo was imposed. The election of Jeb Bush as its governor in 1999, for instance, was a sign that Florida was voting more like a cross-section of the American center than as a collection of hot-button constituencies. If the Castro issue fades away entirely? Well, as Jeb Bush announces this week he's actively exploring a run for the White House, is Florida becoming the ideal place from which to launch a presidential campaign? The thought absolutely terrifies the legendary Carl Hiaasen, novelist, reporter, and columnist for the Miami Herald. His latest book is called Skink, No Surrender.
It's good material for screenplays and novelists. I'm not sure it's good spawning ground for any. The idea that Florida is at play at all in a national election should be terrifying to the rest of the country. But I mean, for writers, it's a great place to be. I mean, when there's 19 million people living here, and it's basically a freak show. So, you know, the rest of us, it's just fun. There's probably a reason why we haven't produced a lot of presidential candidates. It's still a fairly fast developing place. It's not a, you know, I mean, it's a place that's in flux.
Well, let me push back on that for a minute. There's a lot of diversity in Florida. You've got the military panhandle, conservative military panhandle. You've got Central Florida, which is kind of the Disneyfied kind of center of America. Then you've got Miami with all of its sort of ethnic diversity. And then there's all the old folks.
In one sense, it is a terrific cross section. If you can conquer as a candidate in Florida, I think you can win in the country because you have to appeal to so many different base groups here. It's not Iowa. I mean, which is like 98% white. This is a state that has got all different political views. It's got all different demographics. And, you know, to be a popular candidate in Florida, I think means actually you can be a viable candidate on the national stage. I mean, it's anything's possible.
So does that mean there is wind in the sails of Jeb Bush, even as there's plenty of material for columnists like Carl Hiaasen?
Well, look, he's viewed in Florida by most people favorably. He left as a somewhat popular guy, and that was because he was competent. Even if you didn't agree with him, he was a competent governor. And in this political era, competence makes you a rock star. You don't have to be great. You just have to be competent. I think it changes the whole picture for 2016 if he runs. I definitely do. And I think if I'm Hillary Clinton, I don't really want to run against Jeb Bush because he's probably the only Republican candidate who could beat her in Florida right now. The polls show that she would stomp Marco Rubio if the election were held today. But Bush is a whole different story.
Now, putting aside the distortions mentally of those of us who will rub our eyes and look at the bumper stickers and the campaign ads, Bush Clinton once again in 2016, is this a sign that both parties have lost their center and all they can come up with is just Bush and Clinton here?
I don't know. There is a dreary aspect to it all, for sure, and there is certainly a national fatigue about that. But at the same time, I mean, what is the center of the Republican Party? When Jeb Bush left, he was a very conservative governor, and he hasn't changed his positions on most issues, and now he's considered the center of the Republican Party. It's not because he's changed. It's because the party has changed. It's all in flux. And the Democrats, I mean, the truth is they don't have a lot of options. They need a name candidate who gets established early and let the Republicans tear each other apart in the primaries. That's their strategy. Hillary's the only one that can really do that. So I don't know what it says. Politics is a wasteland right now. I mean, everyone's looking for a winner.
Is Hillary the center of the Democratic Party, or is it pure name recognition? And really, if you're going to talk politics, you need to think Elizabeth Warren, which is the progressive voice, that sort of thing.
I don't know, John. I don't think the Democratic Party has a center. I don't think they know what their center is anymore. I mean, and I don't necessarily think that's a terrible thing either. You get defined and pigeonholed. Americans don't think of themselves that way. I mean, Jeb Bush got elected in Florida twice with a lot of crossover Democratic votes at a time when the Democratic Party was much stronger than it is now. People will vote independently in the presidential races the same way they do in the state governor's races. It's not quite as – people, I think, will cross party lines. But I don't think they think of themselves always left. I mean, I don't know anyone that can categorize the state of Florida one way or another, left, right, center, Democrat. We have more registered Democrats than Republicans here.
So let's talk about the fatigue factor for a moment. I think Hillary Clinton is perceived as kind of another version of Bill, but a breath of fresh air in terms of Bill's personal habits, that sort of thing. Jeb Bush, it seems to me, is a real departure from W.
Oh, yeah, he's a totally different cat. I mean, he really is. He is, as they say, the cogitator in the family, thinker. But he's also, I mean, he's the tone, and the New York Times wrote about this, the tone and the persona are more important here probably than his positions. Everyone's going on about immigration and Common Core and how that's going to kill him with the far right. I'll tell you what, he doesn't need the Tea Party in Florida. I mean, the Tea Party is not a big factor here. They will tell you they are. They weren't. They weren't in the last election. Jeb can easily, Florida has 29 electoral votes. Again, terrifying to even imagine that, but that's what we've got. And it's very hard to win the presidency without winning Florida. And he could do that. He can win Florida.
Right.
And he could probably win Texas, depending on where Ted Cruz ends up in the primaries. But
well, Carl, you should go to your calendar and erase that X on January 1, 2016, where you marked John Hockenberry's first call to Carl Hiaasen on the campaign. It's going to be, I guess, my 30th since I managed to get you in 2014. Right? Carl, thanks so much.
Thanks, John. Have a good day.
Novelist, reporter, and columnist for the Miami Herald, Carl Hiaasen's latest book is Skink No Surrender. Now, don't you run for president too, Jeb Bush. You can imagine Barbara Bush saying that in the old days. Maybe Bush is doing it anyways. When's the last time you ignored your mom's advice?
Hi, this is actually an anonymous call from Glenwood Landing. The last time I disobeyed my mother was when she gave me a girdle and told me to wear it. And I threw it promptly in the garbage. When you're 46, that's when you know enough, enough.
From Dallas, Texas, when I was 32, I got a tattoo defying my mother's lifelong ban. I'm 35 now, and after that act of defiance, I haven't dared to disobey again. Your story is at 877-8-MY-TAKE or follow us on Twitter. That's @TheTakeaway, all one word, @TheTakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
What has the reaction been inside Pakistan? The Pakistani military has spoken of avenging this attack by wiping out the Pakistani Taliban. The Pakistani government reinstated the death penalty in a vow to bring the perpetrators to justice. Opposition figure Haider Abbas Rizvi, senior leader of the MQM party, the fourth largest party in Pakistan, has called for the Taliban to be held accountable. Here he is speaking in the city of Karachi.
We demand the prime minister take a serious consideration towards the subject and take Taliban to task. This is about time that we need the national unity on the subject, and we need to take on Taliban by now, because enough is enough.
But does national unity elude Pakistan even as it grieves? Here with more is Akhil Shah. He's the author of The Army and Democracy, Military Politics in Pakistan, currently a visiting professor at Dartmouth College. He grew up in Peshawar and still has family there. First of all, your feelings, Akhil.
Well, it's a day of mourning, tragedy and grief. I know people who've lost their loved ones. So really, it has sent a deep shockwave throughout Pakistan, because, you know, Pakistan has had terrorist attacks before, but nothing of this atrocious scale, where, you know, Taliban militants went into a school and picked up targeted children and shot them in cold blood.
And these are Pakistanis attacking other Pakistanis. What would you say are the divisions that are underscored in the wake of this attack, if there are any?
So the attackers could be from groups allied with the Taliban. For instance, they have carried out attacks on behalf of the Taliban. The Uzbek terrorists from the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, who are holed up in Waziristan and other tribal areas. The divisions are run deep, especially in between the civilian government and the military, which makes a concerted effort to tackle terrorism very difficult. And then within the civilian elite, there are deep disagreements between the former cricketer Imran Khan, whose party now heads the coalition government in the province where this attack took place. And he has taken a kind of apologist cheerleading position for the Taliban and has been in favor of negotiations. But we've seen that negotiations haven't really worked in the past, and the Taliban have used peace agreements with the government to actually entrench themselves more deeply, to reorganize and regroup, and, you know, to kind of start reattacking the Pakistani state and its institutions and, above all, its society.
Does Imran Khan is he under some pressure to react here, to basically suspend his negotiation strategy? How closely are people watching Imran Khan right now?
Yes, I think there's been an outrage because just after the attack, one of the senior leaders of that party was again kind of obfuscating and saying, we don't know who these people are, we don't know where they come from. So there was a reaction to it, and I think Imran Khan, which is why you see him sitting next to the prime minister, he has been adamant and kind of committed to overthrowing in the last few months. So you saw him in the all parties conference that Prime Minister Sharif called, and so I think he thinks it's important to show unity at this point with the government. I don't know how sincere that is. Even in the press conference, he was worried more about the fact that the protest that he was carrying out was about rigging and electoral rigging. So even on a day of national mourning, he couldn't really put it past behind him to talk about the difference he's had with the government.
Let's try to get into the mind of someone in Peshawar right now. Now, I mean, we can't speak for actual militia. I mean, an analyst who we talked with this week have described the entire region around Peshawar as under the grip of a jihadist machine of various groups, including the Taliban. If you're a militia leader in the Peshawar area right now, are you saying to yourself, this will blow over? If you're a cynic, a civilian cynic in Peshawar, are you saying, oh, well, don't expect the government to help me now? Or are you saying, finally, the cavalry will arrive?
I certainly hope that this is a moment of transformation for Pakistan. if this doesn't unite the Pakistani military and civilian leadership against the Taliban, and not just the Taliban, herein lies the problem. The Pakistan military has pursued a well-known policy of differentiating between the good and the bad Taliban, and the Prime Minister, I think, made it a point today saying no more drawing distinctions between the good guys and the bad guys, and I think that goes to the heart of the problem here. The Pakistan military thinks that it can fight some terrorists that attack Pakistan, Pakistani security forces and society, while it can nurture and protect terrorist groups like the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani network and the Lashkar-e-Taiba, who carry out terrorist attacks in India and Afghanistan. So you can't really have a pick and choose approach to counterterrorism. And I certainly hope that this is a wake-up call, although I have my doubts if the past is any yardstick. Previous terrorist attacks have led to similar, statements of resolve that we'll take on the terrorist. But really, nothing has changed on the ground. And the problem is that the Pakistani military is the one that makes national security policy, not the civilian government or parliament.
Akhil, let's just stipulate right at the top that 12-year-old children are, by definition, innocent in affairs of this kind. But let me apologize for this question as I ask it.
Yeah.
There's an argument that for the Pakistani government to call this school some kind of daycare center is a distortion of the facts, that it is, in fact, a training center for army officers, and that basically these young people are being trained to kill Taliban. It's a military target. How do you react to that, and how do Pakistanis react to that argument?
Actually, the Pakistan Army runs a network of schools and colleges, as strange as that it sounds, but it has the children of both military officers and civilians. So it's not necessarily a military feeder or training school. It's actually just like any other public school in Pakistan, the difference being that it's run by the army. So that's really it. It's not that the Taliban think that these kids are being trained to join the army, but that is not necessarily the case. There are army officers and whose kids go to these schools, but it's just like a regular school. It's a target for the Taliban because they, I think, wanted to send a signal that we can hit you where it hurts the most. And so, you've hurt our children and our women, and we're gonna strike back, and we're still alive and well.
And that's the message.
Yes.
Akhil Shah is the author of The Army and Democracy, Military Politics in Pakistan. He's currently a visiting professor at Dartmouth College. He grew up in Peshawar. Thank you, Akhil.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
So finally this hour, the power of controversial books and movies to inflame religious communities around the world has been well demonstrated with writer Salman Rushdie's The Satanic Verses or Mel Gibson's film Passion of the Christ, but it's a global political crisis that seems to be greeting Sony Studios' North Korea takedown comedy, The Interview, with Seth Rogen and James Franco. Sony has had to cancel its New York premiere in the face of a hacking war and a declaration from North Korea's state-run KCNA news agency that the film itself is an act of war. It's about a fictional talk show host, interview of a lifetime with the leader of North Korea.
The CIA would love it if you two could take him out.
Hmm?
Take him out.
Take him out.
Like for drinks?
No, no, no. Take him out.
Take out. Like to dinner?
Take him out to a meal?
Take him out.
Like on the town?
Party?
No, take him out.
You want us to assassinate the leader of North Korea?
Yes.
What?
Well, for weeks, Sony Studios have been reeling from a hack attack that seemed to be linked to the movie rollout. There's evidence suggesting that the North Korean government could be involved. This week, the hackers promised a bitter fate to those who attend any screenings of The Interview, which opens officially next week. Is this an outrageous act of terrorism by backers in support of a brutal dictatorship, attacking the madness of North Korea with satire? Or is it exploitation of the enslaved people of North Korea in questionable taste? Here is writer and North Korean critic Suki Kim, who expresses a sadness that Hollywood seems to believe that North Korea is always fair game for laughs.
I don't know what makes it okay to make jokes about a gulag nation where 25 million people are being held hostage. The funny hairdo of Kim Jong-un and Kim Jong-il, I don't really care. And North Korea hacked Sony's or not? I mean, I would guess probably not. But I don't know why that's also funny.
That's Suki Kim, author of Without You, There Is No Us. She spoke to the program earlier this month. Well, nobody is laughing in Hollywood right now, that's for sure. I'm joined by Sharon Waxman, founder and editor-in-chief of TheWrap.com, which has been all over this story. She joins us from Los Angeles. Sharon, is everyone's head in a bag out there in Hollywood right now?
Well, I think it's people have just felt under siege, really, for the past 3 weeks. And it's just been in the grip of confusion and fear and speculation and anger. It's just been this really unprecedented kind of experience. And as the weeks have gone by, the days have gone by, there has been increasing evidence that North Korea is, in fact, behind this. Because I think there was first like a, you know, cognitive dissonance, like, could that be that? No way, that there's no, that's not possible. But wait a minute, it could be. And the evidence has slowly been coming in. They're finding code that's in Korean. And basically, when we got a letter from Sony's lawyer this week saying that we needed to stop publishing anything of the leaked information that had come, it acknowledged that that was what they believed to be the motive behind it, and is this movie, The Interview. So that's been just it's a game changing moment, I think.
Right.
The idea that this something like this could happen.
The story has shifted to the distributors and the actual theater owners who have to make the decision now whether to show the movie or not. Right.
Well, yesterday was just an incredible day. Among the things that happened was that the hackers put out yet another data dump, this time with the emails of the CEO of Sony Pictures, Michael Lynton, all of his emails. And with that, the threat to conduct some kind of 9/11 attack on theaters if they, in fact, show the movie as planned on Christmas Day. And so both Sony and the theaters now have to make that decision. And what started happening yesterday evening is that one chain, the first one, in my view, because I think it's going to be a series after that, pulled the movie. Carmike Theaters, which is a southern chain, said they are not going to show the movie. And as you mentioned, they've canceled the premiere at a Landmark theater in Soho in New York. And the ArcLight chain, our information is that here in Los Angeles has also canceled it. So that's what's happening now.
And, you know, you are a former Middle East correspondent and you've covered terrorism. In a sense, the way you're describing this hack, the effectiveness of the hack lends credence to the 9/11 threat, correct? And that's what's inflaming the fear here.
Well, yeah. I mean, they have delivered on their threats up to now. So I think it would be absolutely irresponsible to not take seriously the possibility that something really bad could happen, right? I mean, what would happen if who knows? They've promised a Christmas gift on Christmas Day. Now they promise a 9/11 attack. It's unlikely that they could do anything actually violent. But on the other hand, they have delivered, again, as I say, all along over the past 3 weeks. And they had warned Sony before they did the hack on November 24th. They had warned them that something was coming on three or four other occasions throughout the year.
Did anything like this happen in the rollout of Team America? The parody of North Korea, that puppet movie that came out a decade ago?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I remember I was on the set of that movie and I did a very big piece about it with Trey Parker and Matt Stone, the guys behind South Park who did that movie. That's a very different thing. That did make fun of Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's father, but it was a puppet. And remember, that movie really was about parodying and skewering America and American arrogance in how
right.
we conduct our foreign affairs.
I mean,
the difference here also, John, is that it's the first time that I can recall that there's actually the depiction of the assassination of a living sovereign leader who also happens to be a psychotic dictator besides that.
Right. Do you think there's an element here that this is a Japanese-owned studio and that Hollywood seems to think that North Korea, under any circumstances, is fair game for laughs, and somebody wants to put a stop to it, and that doesn't justify terrorism by any means?
I don't think that anybody in Hollywood thinks North Korea is fair game for anything. I don't think it registers on the radar. Seth Rogen and James Franco thought that this would be funny. And Seth has been asked a number of times in interviews, why did you choose not to fictionalize the character? And his answer, I saw him on Colbert a couple nights ago, was like, we sort of thought, why should we? You know, like, why cut the guy some slack? The difference here is that it is possible that there is a heightened sensitivity on the part of North Korea because Sony is a Japanese corporation and they have a history of tension between those two countries, and they are aware that Sony is a Japanese-owned corporation. But on the other hand, it's possible that it's not about a studio or Hollywood wanting to focus on North Korea. I just think it's a little bit of a failure to take the measure of what kind of global world we're living in now.
Indeed, and that there are 25 million people being held hostage in North Korea, and that is the reality, whatever the script says in the movie The Interview. Sharon Waxman, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Sharon Waxman is the founder and editor-in-chief of TheWrap.com. So we're talking about mothers this morning, or you are talking about mothers. Jeb Bush might have ignored his mother's advice when he announced that he was actively exploring a presidential candidacy. When was the last time you disobeyed your mom?
Lynn Ray Pardo, calling from Walnut Creek, California. The last time I disobeyed my beloved mother was 37 years ago when I married my first husband. What a mistake. Oh, my God, what a mistake. So Mom was right. I should have listened.
Lynn, all is forgiven. Give us your disobeying your mom story at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.